Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And Meghna, I'm sure you spent a little time watching this program.
I can tell you 39 years later, I still have all those words memorized. I've definitely watched it as a kid, and the theme song has been a staple for millions of other kids over four decades.
And indeed it has. Me too. Now my son, with the help of Elmo, Big Bird, and Cookie Monster, Sesame Street has helped kids to learn, to spell, to count, and to share.
And now a new study out of Wellesley College shows that those lessons have delivered lasting benefits to millions of children. In fact, the study found that the benefits of watching Sesame Street might be every bit as good as going to preschool.
We'll speak with the head of research and evaluation at Sesame Street shortly, but first we're joined by Wellesley economist Philip Levine, who co-authored the study. He's with us in the studio. And Professor Levine, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So, top line, I mean, this found that Sesame Street really delivers a bang for its buck. What did you find?
Well, we knew from existing studies that instantaneously Sesame Street would increase test scores among kids who watched it. What we're able to do in our study is to go forward a little bit and see through the educational system as kids progress, how are they doing later on. And what we find are pretty strong results that kids are more likely to start school on time and progress through school on pace with, you know, their appropriate age. So, for instance, if you start school at age 6 and in first grade, and you should be at fourth grade at age 10, you're more likely to do that if you've seen Sesame Street.
Right. So tell us how you conducted this study, because it's such an interesting, important detail about how you were able to do it. And it has to do with the way these programs were broadcast back in 1969 and through the 70s.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with technological limitations at the time of TV broadcasts. And this is something that, you know, listeners are going to struggle with the concept of TV back then, but it was broadcast over radio waves. And if you were in certain locations, it would be broadcast over something called a VHF signal. In other locations, it would be broadcast over a UHF signal. Here in Boston, on Channel 2, it would be a VHF signal, which is a very good one. People in Boston would easily be able to see the show. Other people in locations like Los Angeles or Chicago or Washington, D.C., where it was broadcast over a UHF channel, would struggle to see the show. So what we have is, you know, the equivalent of something that we call a natural experiment, where just by luck of the draw, some people got to see the show and others would have more difficulty seeing the show. And we could just look for, you know, were there greater improvements in educational outcomes among the ones who could see it.
Right. And you found particular educational improvements among Black and Latino viewers, right?
African-American children, and importantly, children who grew up in economically disadvantaged areas, which was important because that was one of the fundamental goals of the show when it was first created, was to help reduce the education gap that existed between more and less advantaged kids.
Right. So how do we know that it was Sesame Street and not some other factor? I don't know, maybe parents in Boston are reading to their kids more at earlier ages than parents in Los Angeles. How can we be sure it was Sesame Street?
So we know it's not about the parents in the sense that we're not actually looking at viewers. We're looking at people in the different locations.
Right.
So and what we have, again, is this random shock that occurs where everybody in Boston can now see the show and only some of the people in Los Angeles could see the show. And so if you suddenly see improvements in outcomes among children in Boston relative to the children in Los Angeles, then it's got to be about the exposure to the show and not about anything, because, you know, what else has changed in those particular locations at exactly that moment in time?
Right. So what's the big sort of takeaway from this study? What does it tell you? Because, I mean, it seems like a big bang for the buck, right?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of important takeaways from the study. The first is that it really seems like it is possible for electronic communication to have an impact on educational outcomes. It seemed like that's exactly what we're finding here. Another important outcome, I think, is in a bigger picture perspective, is what does this say about early childhood education and what can we do to improve early childhood education in the United States? In no way are we trying to say that, you know, we should be replacing preschool programs with a television show. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But what it does say is this is a great opportunity to augment the sorts of benefits that preschool can bring leverage those investments in early childhood education through more formal techniques with electronic media and actually generate better outcomes, even better outcomes.
All right, listeners, we want to hear from you on this, about this. Did you grow up watching Sesame Street? Do you think it has added, or how do you measure the kind of educational value that it has added? Do you watch it with your kids? And if just 1 hour of TV can deliver such a big educational bang as this study suggests, what does that say about the potential of TV as an educational tool? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. With me in the studio is Philip Levine. He's an economic professor at Wellesley College, co-author of the study Early Childhood Education by MOOC, Lessons from Sesame Street. And we'll talk about what that... I want to get into this whole idea of MOOC, a massive online... Sorry, what does that stand for again?
Massively open online...
Courses. That's it. And so we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, let me bring in Jennifer Kotler-Clark. She's Vice President of Research and Evaluation at Sesame Workshop, has a PhD in child development. And Jennifer Kotler-Clark, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this must this study must be a kind of must be hugely satisfying to you. But let me ask you about what kind of research and thought process goes into making a Sesame Street episode.
Well, that's a great question, and we were thrilled to hear about this study, and we did not know about it until very recently. So, in fact, we were completely independent of it. But for years, throughout Sesame Street's existence, research has been a huge part of the show, and it's not just research directly with children, although we do plenty of that. It's also really understanding the landscape of child development and child policy, and to understand what are the critical needs of children and how we can use the show to help them grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. So we each year we consider an experimental season where we're really hearing what are the needs of children, and then we do some preliminary research with children and with in conversations with a variety of child development experts, and then we start the writing process, and we'll go out and test some of the shows to make sure that children understand the concepts and that they're relatively novel to them, and then we will make modifications to make sure that, in fact, the show is delivering on what we're hoping that it will deliver.
Well, I feel like we should hear an example. So let's listen to one. This is a sequence that involves Cookie Monster, and he's on a competition show with Guy Smiley called The Waiting Game, and basically the idea is that if Cookie Monster can wait to eat his cookie until Guy comes back, he'll get two cookies instead of one. So here it is.
Oh, who me kidding? Me no can wait. Me have to have cookie now.
Ah. Good things come to those who wait. Good things come to those who wait.
Oh, who you?
We're the Guy Smiley Singers.
Hey!
Why waiting game have singers?
Because singing is a really great strategy to use when you have to wait for something that's really hard to wait for.
Oh, in that case, me try musical strategy. If me can wait to eat this cookie.
Okay, there's Cookie Monster using singing, and the idea there, good things come to kids who wait. Jennifer, I have to ask you, so that's borrowed from the marshmallow test, right? The delayed gratification test?
Exactly. So yeah. We had the founder of the inventor of the marshmallow test, who is Dr. Walter Michel, and he came and spoke to our education and our production team, and he explained the importance of self-regulation. And so from that, the writers created this skit, and in that skit, you see Cookie Monster tries a bunch of different strategies. So singing was one of it, one of the strategies. Covering up the cookies were one of it. Thinking that the cookies were something else, like smelly fish, which he has no interest in. And in fact, we worked with a professor, Deb Leinbarger, at the University of Iowa, and she actually did a study showing that children were able to delay gratification as a function of watching that clip, along with a bunch of others around self-regulation.
Jennifer, this is such a treat having you on the show, because I have to ask you a question that I've always wanted to ask the folks at Sesame Street about Cookie Monster. So
yeah.
He's constantly this guy who just he has no self-control. Every time he's presented with a cookie, he's like, and I got to tell you, actually, I have a little bit of a bone to pick with you. When my son was like 2 or 3, the first time he saw Cookie Monster, he spent the next day or two sort of imitating him and jamming cookies into his mouth and making a mess all over the house. So, so thanks a lot for that. But give me the thinking behind Cookie Monster and how he works as a kind of educational tool.
Well, I think what's fascinating about Cookie Monster in terms of the whole self-regulation and grit and all that's coming out now about how we know that executive function and that sort of the control center of your brain is really one of the biggest predictors of long-term success, both academically and socially, that we realized, in fact, he would be a perfect example of how someone who has a lot of difficulty with self-control and self-regulation, and how he can even learn how to do that as well.
Right.
So, you know, this idea that he really is gluttonous, and that it's very funny, we had an episode where he says, "Me glutton, not liar," when he was accused of something, but, you know, he, which was obviously a wink to the parents, which they always love.
Yeah.
He struggles with this as many young children do.
Right.
And he's very singularly focused, but he is therefore the best poster child for teaching this kind of strategy. Yeah.
So, Philip Levine, I'd love to ask you sort of specifically, what could your research mean for education policy? I mean, more TV shows in the classroom? I mean, where does this take us?
I think that sort of thing. I think that we spend a lot of time talking about early childhood education these days. It seems like it's in favor, you know, really kind of on both sides of the political spectrum. And, you know, the programs that we talk about and sort of, you know, encouraging those activities are things like, you know, Head Start, universal pre-K, you know, class size reductions, you know, really sort of intensive preschool programs. We're not saying that any of those things are bad, but it seems like we have, with Sesame Street or other forms of educational TV, you know, the largest form of intervention that's ever taken place in this country at the lowest possible cost. It seems like something that's the sort of thing that we should be incorporating into those discussions.
Now, you made reference to this before, but do you worry that folks could look at your study and say, hey, we can get the same benefit from an hour of TV that we can get from an entire preschool program? So why bother, you know, why bother spending the big dough on these big programs?
Yeah, we absolutely do not agree with that perspective. I mean, there's clearly something that a teacher in a classroom delivers that a television show could not.
Sure.
We are absolutely not trying to contradict that. All we're trying to say is that you can supplement that those forms of instruction in such a low-cost way that's proven to have such a big impact. Why not do it?
Philip Levine and Jennifer Cutler-Clark, stay with us. We've got some callers who want to get in on this conversation. So let's go to Shannon, who's calling from Milton. Shannon, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm so excited to be able to say thank you to Sesame Street publicly because I have two children. I have a son who's 20 months old, and I have a daughter who's 4 and a half. My daughter has Down syndrome. And foremost, I'd like to say that it's so wonderful to see a TV show every day that has such a huge representation of people of all abilities, of all backgrounds. We see children with Down syndrome. We see children in wheelchairs. And then not only that, my daughter, being a visual learner, has just learned letters, numbers. She counts the sides of every shape now, and I credit the Flying Fairy School episode with Pandora's lunchbox explodes onto the scene, and they need to make the hexagon out of the tortilla chips. So you see 6 tortilla chips become the hexagon, and then they count the sides, and it's hilarious. I mean, my daughter's sense of humor, she laughs at the appropriate places. There's an episode where the happy scientists go around Sesame Street, and they have a hypothesis that does everybody on Sesame Street take baths, and it starts off with Chris in the bathtub. And every time she sees the episode, she wants to take a bath.
Yeah,
with Chris.
Shannon, these are great. These are great anecdotes. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you,
Jennifer. I loved hearing Shannon talk about her kid being a visual learner, and it seems like Sesame Street, in particular, would be a great focus for kids who are in particular visual learners.
Right. And I think what's great in general about quality educational media is that it really does provide visuals and picture, moving pictures to some things that children are curious about or interested in. And so seeing that come to life in that way, particularly for children who don't have access to those kinds of interesting things in their real life.
Right.
And as a reinforcement for those who actually do. So, this idea of Shannon's recollection of the happy scientist and taking a bath, and we were able to make something so everyday turn into really a science lesson. So, and about making hypotheses and collecting data for preschoolers. So,
sure. Well, all right, well, let's take a couple more calls. Let's go to April, who's calling from Beverly. Hi, April, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I just want to say, first of all, I'm 50. I grew up with Sesame Street, and it was absolutely an essential part of my childhood. But I have a son who's 14, and when he was small, I used to try to get him to watch Sesame Street, and I would always put it on and be sitting there myself enjoying it. The problem is there were so many other choices. We were sort of a captive audience back then. We watched it because there wasn't a lot else on, as much as we liked it. But now there's so much competition that the kids sort of get dragged away from it. So it's a great tool, but it would almost have to be used in schools where they're a captive audience again.
Well, April, you bring up a great point, and I wanted to ask Philip Levine about this. I mean, actually, and Jennifer, too, but I'll start with you, Philip. I mean, it really is a different sort of TV landscape out there. I remember it. I was a kid in 1969, 1970, when Sesame Street first came on the air, and as April said, at a certain point in the day, if you wanted to watch a kid's show, it was Channel 2. That was it. Mm. Yeah.
It was remarkable. The ratings for Sesame Street back then were just astronomical. Roughly 5 million kids per day watched a typical episode of Sesame Street. That's the preschool equivalent of a Super Bowl every single day.
That's amazing. That's literally true.
Literally
true. Equivalent of a Super Bowl rating. That's incredible.
About a third of all children between 2 and 5 years old were watching a particular episode. Clearly, that's not where we are today. There were 3 channels then. There's 500 now.
Yeah.
It raises 2 questions. The first is, do we have any sense that in a modern era, in a contemporary environment, is that form of media effective? And the answer is yes, that we have other evidence from actually the Cookie Monster experiment that Jen was talking about a few minutes ago, but also from a television show called Super Why and some others that actually show that in randomized controlled trial settings that even in today's environment, these shows can be effective in improving children's outcomes. But I do think it also brings in this question of how do you get the captive audience? And I think that the schoolroom environment is exactly where you get the captive audience, that incorporating Sesame Street content into or other educational TV shows into a classroom environment, or through the teacher saying, "Here's your homework for tonight."
Yeah. And what about that, Jennifer? Is Sesame Workshop considering working with school districts to create a Sesame Street curriculum?
Well, it's a great question, and we were thinking the same thing, and we have partnered with teaching strategies to provide Sesame Street content in schools. And we're also working with Success for All, and we have provided Sesame Street content to go along with school curriculum as well. So we are doing something more with formal learning. And we just also hear informally that because we are such a comprehensive curriculum and that we're a whole child and that we've been around for so long, that so much of our content is relevant to preschool curricula, that a lot of teachers are using our content in schools that way, and through our website and through YouTube channel, we're able to provide that to classrooms as well.
Mm. Well, it's a really interesting conversation, very interesting study from Philip Levine. He's an economics professor at Wellesley College. You can find a link to his study at our website, radioboston.org. And Philip Levine, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
And Jennifer Kotler-Clark is Vice President of Research and Evaluation at Sesame Workshop. Jennifer, thanks to you, and thanks for all those decades of Sesame Street.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead coming up. Magna boards the USS, Constitution, which is getting a major facelift. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.